Benedict and Beyond, a talk by Cardinal George Pell at Eyewitness 2013.
I want to go back a little way, and I want to start with where we are. It's a very obvious point, but sometimes we forget it. It's important to realize that we're a minority. We Catholics are a minority. We Catholics who take it seriously are a smaller minority. We're much less poor than we used to be because of the good Catholic education system. And built into many of us is the sort of an aspiration for, at least back in my generation, an aspiration for social mobility and also to be accepted, to be like the majority. And the way the majority is moving, that's becoming more and more difficult for us. In other words, if we're following Christ seriously, in some areas it's much appreciated by society, our concern for the poor, our concern for the battlers, but in other areas of life and sexuality and marriage, we're increasingly differentiated. Last year was the 50th anniversary of the start of the Second Vatican Council. And that was called by a plump pope called John the 23rd. He was elected at around about the age of Pope Francis. He might have been a bit older. And they say the cardinals elected him because they thought he'd just keep things ticking over for a new pope and he wouldn't do too much damage and wouldn't do too much of this or that. And then against all the odds, he called the Second Vatican Council. None of you would know what it was like to live before the Second Vatican Council, but it was a significantly different world. First of all, in the Latin Rite, all the masses were in Latin. There was no official, Catholics were discouraged from ecumenical activity. You were not allowed to go to the funeral or the marriages of non-Catholic relatives. Two little stories. A priest I know, he was in the Second World War, and his non-Catholic mate had asked him to be best man at his wedding. So he was going through Ballarat, and he asked the Bishop of Ballarat for special permission, and the bishop refused to give it. But the fellow who became a priest went ahead and was best man in any case. Only back in about 84, I think it was, I was parish priest at a little Irish-Australian village. We don't call them villages, a little small country town just outside Ballarat called Bungaree. Most of the people there were Catholic. And we had the first ever ecumenical evening together with the Anglicans. We prayed together. And it was a strong parish. All the young people used to come to Mass. Some of them would sit on the floor at the back of the church underneath so you couldn't quite see what they were doing. But literally, they were all there. And one of the fellows who came along to the ecumenical service said, I've never been here before except once. He said, and the last time I was here, I came as a kid to stone the church, the Anglican church. A different world. My father wasn't a Catholic. Like all mixed marriages, you couldn't be married in the church, at the church building. You had to be married in the sacristy. So there are some old churches in Melbourne and in Sydney where the sacristies are quite grand, quite lovely. And it was precisely so that when the marriages took place there, people would be less upset. Um, We were encouraged to be very defensive. This whole idea that we would dialogue and collaborate with people of goodwill, that wasn't nearly as prevalent as it is today. When they wrote the document, when the Council Fathers wrote the document on the church, it was a revolution because they spoke about the baptized people before they spoke about the clergy. Now, we take that just for granted. Most Catholics are lay people. We know that in theory and hopefully in practice, we priests are there to serve the people and to serve the world. But theoretically, that was something that was new. The council said explicitly that the state had no right to enforce Catholic practice or to coerce anybody's conscience. And we all believe that. And you'll need to use that in your lifetime to resist the encroachment of the state on our liberties. That's already starting to happen. Down in Melbourne, a Catholic or a doctor who's pro-life has to refer a woman who wants an abortion to a pro-abortion doctor. Archbishop Julian was here speaking, I think today or yesterday, and in Tasmania, you cannot demonstrate against abortion within 150 meters of an abortion clinic. The interesting thing is that they brought in this legislation, and it looks as though up to about this time, there are hardly any groups at all who ever did pray or demonstrate in Tasmania. And see that the council has revolutionized Catholic life. Ecumenism has changed the whole ethos in Australia. The English versus Irish, the Catholic versus Protestant thing was something which was very strong. I don't know whether it still happens, but you know, there'd be fights between the state school kids and the Catholic school kids going home from school. There was no money for Catholic schools, and we Catholics were aggrieved about that. And so there was enough sort of pressures on us to help keep us together. Divorce wasn't so easy in those days. I think in the group that I was growing up with, about 50 or 60% of us went to Mass every Sunday. The ones who didn't were an exception. Not too many of the parents in my school group were divorced. Admittedly, we were in the country. I was in a provincial centre at Ballarat. There were no drugs around Ballarat, at least amongst the school children. There wasn't any television until I was 15. So it was a different world. The Second Vatican Council came and changed so many of these things for the better. The new lay movements that we have in the church, they've come out of nowhere. The charismatic movement developed unexpectedly. The World Youth Days were something that would come much later with John Paul II. So immediately after the council, there was a Pope Paul, and his job was to implement the council. It was a very difficult job because once you get people to reform, it's difficult to keep them there so that it doesn't become a revolution. And all sorts of unexpected, which we had never expected, things happened. The most spectacular of those was that I'm not quite sure how many years, 10, 15, might be more, 32,000 priests throughout the world left the priesthood. And probably as many brothers, possibly more brothers and nuns, at least in our part of the world. And the number of vocations dropped spectacularly. And there arose a great confusion, especially morally. And that spread. First of all, it was on the rights and wrongs of artificial contraception. and people felt they could make their own mind up on that. And now it's spread. So nature of marriage, whether abortion's wrong, homosexual unions, homosexual activity, a lot of people will say that, you know, they're good Catholics in inverted commas and all these things are okay. The situation has settled down more now than it was 10 or 15 or 20 or certainly 25 years ago. One of the reasons it's settled down is we've managed to get a better type of religious education in the schools, and people are more sensitive to the issues. See, for your generation, sociology generally won't carry you along with the church. Most of you who've decided to come here have already had to stand up on your feet at some stage or other and either say your piece or be quiet or leave, but you've had to take a stand somewhere or another for your faith. We had to do that less back in the ancient times, but it was still necessary. And then in 1978, we had John Paul II from Poland. Most of you wouldn't remember the communist empire. The rulers in China are nominally Marxist or communist. They don't believe a word of it. But in the days when communism was strong, they did believe it, and they did persecute the Christians and Catholics, the immense network of concentration camps, the Gulag in Russia. And that all collapsed in 1989. And one of the big factors in it was the Pope from Poland, John Paul II, who will be canonized on Mercy Sunday, a week after next Easter Sunday. And I'm quite clear in my own mind that John Paul the Great, as I like to call him, was one of the greatest popes in history. And not just because of his pivotal role in the overthrow of communism. It was really providential. Because a man called President Reagan was president of the United States. He knocked off at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. People reckon he was stupid. He was stupid enough to be elected twice as governor of California and twice as president. He had some very, very clear ideas, and he reckoned that communism was an evil empire. So he went in to knock it over. And then we have Margaret Thatcher in Britain, a much less important figure, but nonetheless important, and also she was a goer. She wanted it to be knocked over, and we had this Catholic Pope. I never dreamt that I'd see the end of communism. And I was at a conference about 18 months before communism collapsed, and there were people from all over the world, experts, and there was only one fellow who said the communist empire was about to collapse. He was a fellow called Knopfel Marker, lived here in Australia, Hungarian Jew. And they ridiculed him. It was for him to say that, and he was within a couple of years he was validated. Now the other great thing John Paul II did was to stabilize the church after all the confusion, the exodus of priests, stabilize the church in the Western world. And a lot of bishops and leaders disagreed with what he was doing. They were happy to be going along. You might almost say going out of business. In Holland, the church was as strong as the church was in Ireland and in Quebec. They had 50 or 60% going to Mass every Sunday. They had, I don't know about Quebec, but certainly Holland had as many missionaries overseas pro rata as Ireland. In both those countries, the church has collapsed radically. They're selling off about a church a week in Holland, I was just reading. 2 or 3% are going to Mass. to euthanasia capital of the world. In Quebec, also the church fell over there. Another radical dissolution. And it's not much better in Belgium. And in the old East Germany, 80% of the people are not baptized. Now, John Paul II did a lot to stabilize that, to point out what was essential. The temptation after the council was to think we would do better if we weren't too hard, if we went soft, if we cut off the corners of Christ's hard teaching. And it doesn't work. You've got to present the fullness of Christ, the person. Love, faith, and hope, and love have got to be in the center. But to the extent that we move away from what Christ wanted, our efforts are diminished. John Paul realized what was happening with the young people, that many of them were drifting away. And so he said, well, we're going to try to start these World Youth Days. And I believe a lot of his advisors said, oh, no, let's not do that because we'll put it on and none of the young people will come and then it'll look worse than ever. I think the first one wasn't a great success. I think they concentrated exclusively on the parishes and didn't get a spectacular return. After that, they explicitly invited more of the movements. And then the World Youth Days are off and running. And I hope you young people are a little bit different. But I think John Paul understood that young people today, and this has been going since I think the 80s, so over the last 20 or 30 years, very much like to get together in big groups, a sense of community, and seem to be more happy to come along two or three or four times a year to a gathering rather than to sign up for a weekly meeting or a weekly something or other. But whatever about that, that was one of the greatest contributions of John Paul. A Pole, a poet, philosopher, an intellectual, and very much a leader, and used to being opposed, actively opposed by the communist government. And the church in Poland was much stronger than it was in most other parts of Eastern Europe. And so they were able to resist the government. And one of his great achievements as Archbishop of Krakow was they, in a new working suburb in Nowa Huta, they managed to build a great big Catholic church there against all the opposition for years of the government. Then we had Pope Benedict. A German, an intellectual, very much, I think, probably the greatest living theologian today, a gentleman, a German gentleman of the old school, a wonderful man. Many of you would have seen him here when he came for World Youth Day. I popped in to see him about 8 or 9 days ago, and he was telling me what wonderful memories he has of the World Youth Day here in Sydney. And in a great way, he was able to reach out to the thinking people, the non-religious thinking people around the world, formally, as a sort of a dialogue. I think his greatest contribution was in the liturgical world. Because he stressed the fact that when we come together to pray, to celebrate the Eucharist, it's not just a community get-together. It's not just like a happy hour or a concert where we all enjoy one another's company and we come for a bit of entertainment. Benedict insisted that worship is the adoration of the one true God through Christ, his only Son. So it's a prayer. Or it's nothing. Frequently people will say to me, that was lovely Mass, Father, or lovely Mass, Cardinal. And when I mightn't say it quite so regularly now, but I used to always say, yes, it was a good Mass because we prayed. And it's not a good mass if we don't really pray, even if the music is beautiful. The mass is not a performance. You can see even that sometimes with musical groups. And I've said to these musical groups on occasion, you know, you're not there to give a concert. You are there to encourage people to pray. You're to encourage them to join in and sing. The Pope reached out to the Anglicans, and a number of them have come on board. He reached out to the so-called Lefebvreists. They're ultra-conservative Catholics who left the church, celebrate Mass in Latin, left the church because they're attached to old things, and they particularly objected to the doctrine of the Vatican Council saying that the consciences cannot be coerced by the state. He fell over backwards, he dialogued with them once or twice. It looked as though they were going to sign on board, or their leadership was happy to sign. But whatever about that, that time has come and gone. The extreme members among them say that our Mass is not valid. It's not a real Mass. Well, I mean, that's nonsense. You can have Mass in Latin, and it can be very beautiful, and often it accents the transcendental dimension a little bit better than our liturgies do in the vernacular, the new so-called new rite. It's been simplified from the old Mass, but overwhelmingly, the new Mass for me and for most people is better, and you often see that when they celebrate the old Tridentine Mass, they cheat a bit and incorporate some of the elements from the new liturgy. And then we've got Pope Francis from South America. Very different world. Very different world culturally. We're an Anglo world culturally. The Hispanic culture is very, very powerful. Got its own style. Argentina 100 years ago was one of the most prosperous countries in the world, like the Australian colonies. Now it's way down the list. So in Buenos Aires, there are 20 or 22 enormous areas of slums. And obviously a bishop in a place like that has got to be concerned for those. We don't have poor in the way they do in many parts of South America. We have poor people, but not quite of that level of poor, of poverty. But many of the people who are really poor and their lives have disintegrated here, it's because they can't handle the social security they get. So our poverty is more of a spiritual poverty. Just recently I was talking to the leader of a religious group and he was wanting to come up into Sydney. And I said, yeah, no, that'd be lovely. And among other things, not quite in this sequence, he said, you know, they want to work with the poor. And I said, look, everybody's working with the poor. In a sudden, I trailed my coat a bit and said, it's easy to be working with the poor. It's much easier to work out in the west of Sydney than it is in other areas. Being an Anglo myself, I said, it's the Anglos are the challenges. It's the blue eyes who are much more irreligious. It's them that I would like you to work with. And he said, oh, we'd have to pray and discern about that. And I said, you know. don't hang around too long. But more seriously, he said, I'm not sure that I've got the people to do all the things that people are asking us. This is the letter. It's called an apostolic exhortation. It's a letter. It's not an encyclical for some reason of Pope Francis. And it's 200 pages, so if you never read a book, I suppose this is a good place to start. But if you are into reading books, I thoroughly recommend it to you because There are lots of interesting things in it, and I'll mention one or two of those. Francis has given us a boost that we haven't had. I'm not even sure we had it in the days of Pope John the 23rd, or even in the first days of John Paul II. Going, and non-Catholics particularly like him. I mean, the Catholics do too. Very, very obviously. He's getting massive numbers at the Wednesday audiences. Often 50,000, sometimes 100,000. There's a street that leads up to St. Peter's Square called the Via di Conciliazione, and on some of the Wednesday audiences, there have been thousands of people in the couldn't get into the square. A couple of months ago, I had to go there for to the Vatican for a meeting at 8:30 in the morning, and I went past the audiences at 10:30, and the square was full, and there were still hundreds of people coming. And I don't know whether it's happened to you, but it certainly happened to me. Going around in all sorts of places, people will say to me, "You've got a good Pope." Now, a couple of reasons for that. See, he is an old-style Jesuit. And the Jesuits were very well-trained, very disciplined men of faith. And so, very explicitly, everything he's talking about, he has Christ at the center. And he made the point very eloquently. I'd made it, I think, once or twice before, but not with his force or eloquence. And that is, Christ is at the center of everything. Even the right to life. It's no substitute for Christ. Work for social justice. Work for ecology. Work for the liberation of women. Work against trafficking, slavery. And there's loads of slaves today. All these things are wonderful, but they're no substitute for Christ at the center. And he is saying that. He's got an unusual approach to some of us laced up, buttoned up, older fashioned types. One reporter said, a number of Catholics like the older brother in the story of the prodigal son. Do you remember the older brother was unhappy because the dad was having a big party with a no-hoper son who'd come back. Changed his ways, completely broke, and came home. And I said, yes, well, I'm one of the older brothers. And I said, and our duty is to be absolutely the opposite of what the older brother was in the parable. We've got to support the Pope as he goes out to people on the edges. And in his letter here, he's got a section where he talks about Christ meeting the Samaritan woman. I remember he asked her whether she was married, and she equivocated a bit, and the Lord said, yes, yeah, that's very right. You've had five husbands, and the fellow you're with now is not your husband. And she said, five husbands and a partner. Quite an interesting lady. Jesus converted her. And she went off back to the village saying, look, I've met the Messiah, the person we're waiting for. And he said, he's talking about going out to the peripheries. And he says, the fact that Christ has come amongst us should have produced what he calls a revolution of tenderness. And he says the central mystery, the central virtue is what he calls mercy. Now, the three basic theological virtues are faith, hope, and charity. So he's renamed charity, love, with the title of mercy. I used to teach literature in Argentina, and he's got an interesting way with words. And I mean, one very good point he makes, which is true for you as much as it is for me, I sometimes look a bit miserable when I'm thinking, and I was walking along a street next to a building site years ago, and one of the builders shouted out and said, hey, mate, can't be as bad as all that. And I said to him, no, I said, it isn't. The Pope said, Christians shouldn't be regularly looking like people who've just come from a funeral. And that is very true. He said, we should realize that the cross is a symbol of victory. We shouldn't go running around with, as though we've got no confidence in what we're about. And he's got some beautiful passages about us being frightened to put our head up above the parapet, becoming nervous, not wanting to be different. I know all about that. So do you. And once you've taken a stand once or twice, of course, it's much easier afterwards. I remember I was told that a year or so ago, somebody said, if you take a firm stand on principle, you know, really against the tide, say with your friends or in some other situation, he reckoned if you did that 3 times on 3 significant occasions, you're free for the rest of your life. Because it means when the chips are down, you're prepared to stand up and say that's it. And the Pope's also got a beautiful section for people like myself who've been battling along for a while, you know, about the dangers of getting embittered or disillusioned. He spoke of a grey melancholy. And he said the antidote to that is regular prayer, keeping our faith nourished. And if we don't nourish our activity, we can even sort of collapse physically too, become ill. And he said, but then if it goes even further, we can become without any life at all, like a tombstone. He said, like Egyptian mummies. And he used the word that one of the states we can be in as we progress towards that, he said, we shouldn't be like sourpusses. I haven't seen the Latin original of this, but I'll be very fascinated to see what the Latin is for sourpuss. We've got a new and very, very interesting Pope. One of the criticisms of Pope Benedict was that he didn't speak to enough people. So the Pope is changing that already. So he's got this commission of 8 cardinals from around the world. I happen to be one of them. We've met twice for 3 days. He's been with us nearly all the time. He doesn't intervene much. This probably hasn't happened in the papacy since the Middle Ages. There's a thing called the Synod, which is a group of 250 bishops and lay people who meet every few years as a council of the Synod. I'm a member of that. And he came along for 2 half-days to that. And people could say what they wanted to or about the problems facing the church in his presence. And just a final thing where he's doing very good work is within the organization of the Vatican. You all would have read about Vatti leaks, about Paolo the butler, who sent out 6,000 pages of private messages. You would have heard about a fellow called Scarano, a Monsignor, who was laundering €20 million euros worth and got caught and is now in jail. You would have heard that the head and the deputy head of the Vatican Bank had to step down. The Pope, I think, is just the man to really clean up a lot of these things. And financially, a lot of good work has been done already. And there's not many leaks now for the moment. And with a bit of luck, that'll continue. So pray for the Pope. He'll need a lot of courage to really clean the thing up in Rome. He'll need our prayers and our support. It won't revolutionize the church, but it will help if at the center of things, it's pretty sensible and pretty solid. So pray for the Pope. He's a most interesting man. He's occasionally a bit indiscreet in what he says, which helps make him even more interesting. He's absolutely orthodox. There were stories you know, that he was soft on abortion. That's completely untrue. But a lot of people thought that. There's a story. See, he has these meals with the other priests and the few visitors who come in at a house called Santa Martha's in Rome in the Vatican. And there was a group of young people from Argentina, pro-lifers. And he's walking out, he greeted them. And they seemed to be pretty outspoken there, some of these South Americans. And he said, what are you doing here? And they said, oh, we've come on a pro-life pilgrimage. But it looks like you've said that's not really important. And he said, no way. No. They said, you support us in Argentina, but we're not sure you support us now. And he said, that's not the case at all. What has happened is that the left of center, the traditional anti-Christian papers, have reckoned that the Pope is a good guy. So when he talks about the devil, when he's opposed to abortion, when he says women can't be priests, etc., etc., they just don't run it. It doesn't. They don't put it into their papers, and the press is a bit like that. So as I said, pray for the Pope. He's a most interesting and wonderful man, and he'll please God with grace and wisdom. He'll leave the church much strengthened. So I'm happy for you to take a few questions.
You have been listening to a talk from Cardinal George Pell. Eyewitness was held at Stanwell Tops, New South Wales, in December 2013. The theme for the conference this year was Benedict and Beyond. And for more talks, interviews, and shows, visit cradio.org.au.